Today is Wednesday. It's February 23rd, 2022. It is 2:38 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and we are The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record each week and broadcast sometimes Saturday nights on WGN Radio at 8 o'clock. We'll take a little hiatus here because of Blackhawk hockey. You can also hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Hey, guys, it's Brandon Pelt from CW26 Chicago.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, your man in Savannah. I write for my own publication, the Picayune Sentinel, and occasionally for the Daily Herald.
We've been through Savannah before and really liked it. And it was like I thought in the books. Eric, you like Savannah. You're there today, huh?
Yeah, we are spending 2 weeks down here. We spent 2 weeks down here last winter. We just drive down, take our laptops, keep working. It is a gorgeous town, perfect for walking. It's 80 degrees today. It's a wonderful town. I really, really recommend it.
And it's 80 degrees here in Chicago today, too.
Oh, wonderful.
So
good.
You picked the wrong time to go down. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Is that the book I'm thinking of?
Yes, it is the book you're thinking of. And I'm going to be having dinner with the prosecutor in that case next week.
So. Are you serious?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, he's an old friend of
Eric's in a bit of trouble down in Savannah, unfortunately.
Well, the long story is that he is married to a very good friend of our good friend Mary Schmeek, who grew up in Savannah.
Yeah.
So Mary knows, and so Mary's going to come down here next week. We're going to all hang out, and that'll be fun. We're told he doesn't like the book, though, so we told him to stay away from it. Stay away from it. He doesn't come off all that well in the book.
Well, let's talk about the governor of Illinois. J.B. Pritzker has, cover me on this, guys, appealed a lower court ruling on mask and vaccine mandates to the Illinois Supreme Court. We're talking about schools here. We don't know if the state's highest court will take up the case, but at issue is, does the governor have the power to mandate masks? And today it appears that the governor does not have that power. A couple of weeks ago, a Sangamon County judge ruled on behalf of the plaintiffs in schools across the state and issued a temporary restraining order on the mandates. And since a bipartisan committee has since blocked the governor from enacting more restrictive rules, the appeals court said the issue is moot. So today, pending a Supreme Court ruling, it's up to individual schools. And as of March 1st, we mostly won't have to wear masks indoors anyway. So my question is, why is JB still fighting this thing? Austin, what's your analysis of that? What's up? Why is this thing so important to him this close to the finish line?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And that's the one, like, I've talked so much about the legal intricacies of this because everybody is asking what's going on with the case. What's the difference between an emergency rule and an emergency order and a statute? And what's JCAR? And what's the appellate court? And like, there's so many elements of this that it's really tough for people to keep straight. But I agree with you. That question of why fight this now, I think part of it is to save face with a lot of his biggest political backers, which are teachers unions in Illinois, which have strongly supported this action from him. So I think that's part of it. And he sort of has to be perceived as fighting this all the way to the, like, running through the tape on it. So I think that's one thing. The second might be that members of his administration think that come November, people might not remember this or might not care about what they do either way. So let's go with the folks who we know will back us or who will be mad if we do the wrong thing. So those are my only two. And perhaps there is another case to be made for, well, there's folks in the administration who believe that they have to take every last measure to keep masks in schools for as long as possible. Unfortunately, I think that comes at the cost of actually having any kind of coherent plan for all these schools. And so you have over 500 districts, I believe, now where masks are optional. And the rest of them, I think the longer that this case drags on, rather than putting their own, for instance, collective bargaining agreements or something with teachers in place, will just kind of relent to the most vocal parents who want them to take it off. So that might backfire in some way.
That's the court. That's the court of public opinion.
Well, if I can put the most Pritzker-friendly gloss on this, the possibility is that he might actually want to clarify what his powers are and what they are not. I mean, I think Austin has made some good points all along during the pandemic that Pritzker seems to be taking a very capacious view of what an emergency is and what an emergency order can do. And this does seem to be an unsettled area of law. And there are going to be situations in the future, sadly, in which the governor, maybe not Pritzker, but whoever the next governor is and the next governor after that, there may be another pandemic or other really long-term emergency where it will be nice to know what the governor's powers are and what they are not, and have the Illinois Supreme Court clarify that, so that if they come back and say, you can't do this, then it's good to have that settled, right? And if they come back and say, you can do this, then at least we know that he's not just going by the seat of his pants. So I would think there is I don't know if that's Pritzker-friendly or just sort of civics-friendly, but it does seem to me like it's a good thing that they're taking it to the Supreme Court and getting some clarity on this.
I think ultimately it's going to come down to what are parents going to want? Because it's going to look really weird if for some parents, if this school district is saying you have to wear masks and this one doesn't, it's going to be hard to argue to parents, hey, got to keep those masks on for those kids if the rest of these schools don't have to do it. So in the end, you're going to see, like we're seeing these battles in school board meetings over critical race theory and vaccines and all this. This is just going to be another one of those culture wars that's going to be inflamed because of this inconsistency going on. You have one set of guidelines here, the other here from different politicians, and that is just tough to juggle for parents in general, people in general. It needs just to be a blanketed thing. And so Pritzker doing this, I think he just wants clarity, like Zarek's saying. He just wants to make it as clear as possible. What are my powers here? What can we actually mandate? Because there will be times in the future, this pandemic, who knows what the new variant's going to be?
Yeah.
It's bound to be an issue again.
I don't buy the first part of Eric's gloss that it's him just looking for a good civic resolution so we can all go forward with the same marching orders. I didn't hear him say that.
I mean, he's an attorney, so at some level, he's got to have a notion of what his powers are and aren't. I think this is probably at some level about being consistent in the run-up to his election. Listen, I stood by mask order for kids because I think that in these congregate settings, there's no way to keep them safe. I think that follows a philosophy, as Austin said, that meshes with the teachers unions, the big teachers unions that back him, the Democratic voters who back him. My sense is it's probably more of a politically motivated, I want to think that anybody who is in that seat as governor wants to keep kids safe. There are some studies that sort of back up that sort of the masking where kids are concerned that it can keep them safer. And so maybe he's healing to that. But I also think that it's about being consistent. And I'm not giving him some kind of out here, but just being consistent. I've always backed this.
But times have changed. I hear him pushing for a win. I don't think he's agnostic. Like, let's just set the parameters.
Oh, no. He's a politician. He wants to win. I mean, he's a billionaire. He's accustomed to winning. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of a given, too.
Okay. But I think that's working against the case that he's just looking for guidance on this.
So if his desire was clarity, he really needs to stop making claims about the case itself in press conferences, because it confuses a lot of people when he gives his view on what the press, because right now it's true, school districts can decide yes or no whether or not to have masks. The governor doesn't really say it that way in his press conferences, and I think it makes for more confusion for teachers, for students, and for families. And I think I get Eric's point about you want to take this to the end of the road, really, to see where you stand. But the judges so far have basically said, if the legislature had passed anything on this, this would be moot. You know, they gave him the clarity of saying, no, these powers and the limits on them should be legislatively decided or go through a normal process, through the rules process. But that's been avoided this whole time. So if he was in search of clarity, I think it would be good to start with the legislature and agencies and get them to follow the rules.
That would have been a lot easier, of course, a year ago, year mm-hmm. and a half ago. Mm-hmm. I think right now you've got so many different conflicting currents on this that it would be almost impossible to pass a law like that, even in a heavily democratically controlled legislature. And, you know, I agree. He's probably not doing it just for selfless reasons. Politically, his response to COVID is going to be a much bigger issue if the pandemic is still really going on in November. If it's really kind of a distant memory at that point, I think that the fact that he fought all the way and lost, if he loses, won't really weigh that much on voters' minds, and it'll be something that we'll put behind us.
You don't think this will be an issue on the election?
Not if the pandemic is pretty much in the rearview mirror. I think people have short memories for stuff like that.
Boy.
I think they'll look back and say, you know, he did his best. I mean, a lot of people say right now that he's a terrible person who was a Nazi, making us put on masks. And other people say, well, he did his best. He tried to follow what the science was telling him. And yeah, it wasn't always consistent, but he seemed to have our best interests at heart. And I think those positions are pretty hardened. And I don't think people are going to be voting on the pandemic if it is in the rearview mirror in November.
You guys agree with Eric on that?
They may not be thinking about masks, but I think the people who are already going to vote against him probably were just looking for reasons, and the pandemic will be sort of front of mind. And the folks who already supported him are saying he did his best.
Pandemic response is going to be definitely a part of the campaign for sure. I think that's the reason why you're seeing a lot of things lifting. It's all politics, right? It's rewarding people, you know, for doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? In a sense, people have not been seeing rewards. So here you go. Here's your cookie. So that's really what it comes down to for me. That's still going to be a part of it. But yeah, I'm kind of with Eric. The mask issue itself, if we're at a point where we don't have a variant for a while, or this is behind us, yeah, it could be something that people just have a short memory on.
Well, Austin, that's what John was screaming about a week ago or so, was you've got to give them the cookie. Otherwise, the penalties, the masks and the vaccination requirements become onerous. They seem punitive. Like, if we do our end of the deal, then you got to reward us with fewer restrictions.
Yeah, or just what's the off-ramp, I think, is what a lot of parents are asking, right? At what point is it going to be safe? And I totally get why public health officials are hesitant to say, well, at this point on this date with these five metrics, then definitely you'll be able to, you know, take it off. But then, you know, a new variant arises and people are like, well, what about the advice you gave then? Right. So it's a really difficult challenge. I agree with Brandon in saying that it clearly is becoming a political liability. And you can see that based on the changing nature of restrictions and especially blue states. I do think people are seeing Omicron steeply, steeply decline, and they're looking to policy leaders to act like it.
Well, is it instructive to note that the commercial I saw for J.B. Pritzker's campaign did not mention his handling of the pandemic? It was more about the bond rating or the financial improvements the state's made. He's not championing how he's led us to safety.
Oh, definitely. I think the financial improvement that you see, which is mostly due to federal aid, will be a really, really huge part of his campaign. The increased credit rating, for sure. He's still going to be, in some sense, running against Bruce Rauner. And he'll say, look what happened under this previous guy. It's definitely not that bad. Give me another shot.
The theme of this campaign is going to be leading through difficult times. I mean, that is an opaque reference, of course, to the pandemic. But his team has already suggested that that is going to be a running theme. He'll probably trot out, who is Emily Landon? She's the public health doctor at the University of Chicago, who seems to be, has a bit of a flair for the dramatic, and talks about how dire things are, how much better things are getting.
Make no mistake, Illinois, today is not the day to stop the mask mandate. There are still way too many cases, but things are changing quickly. They're improving.
I agree with Lisa. I think if you compare like an Allison Arwady to an Emily Landon, I think Arwady's tone is more what you'd be used to seeing from a public health official. Whereas Landon, I agree with Lisa, is a little...
There's no one measure or metric, but rather an understanding of the needs and the pain in the community.
Yeah, I guess like theatrical or dramatic is sort of what I would... A little extra. That's a good
extra.
expanded. Yeah.
As the kids don't say anymore, yes.
Eric, you were smiling when Lisa was making one of her points. What's on your mind?
When we talked about this is going to be a race with the Pritzker against Rauner again, even though Rauner isn't running, I think that's really a smart observation that with Ken Griffin's money in the race, it's going to allow the Democrats just to rewind to the Rauner years and say, do you want a return of one of Ken Griffin's people in the governor's office? And I think people will say no to that. That might be where the campaign this year is going to be headed.
They've already framed it, they meaning the Pritzker team, they've already framed it this way. They've already brought out that point to multiple outlets. Like, well, this is somebody who supported failed Bruce Rauner, basically. Why would you want to support his candidate now?
But you know, about the lack of clarity that we have, I noticed that the Elk Grove Village mayor wants them to set up their own independent health department. So if there's ever an issue like this, they won't be dependent upon the city or the state, to make decisions for them. Well, I'm an advocate for localizing some of these decisions. It seems to me like that's the case in the extreme.
What, has he got a sister-in-law who's got a public health degree?
You know, it's one thing.
How it works?
It's one thing to be a mayor, and God bless you. I mean, thank you for your service. But at some point, I think you've got to defer to people who are experts. I had a conversation on the radio today with Blaine Willauer, who is the Beecher City downstate lawmaker, who said that the claim, quotes around claim, that masks are efficacious in schools for kids is completely wrong. He said that all along. Darren Bailey's on his side on this. The Better Government Association, or what he called the Big Government Association, fact-checked that and deemed it mostly false. He doesn't trust the CDC, and he doesn't trust all of these upstate smarty-pants people.
Well, doesn't this underscore the difficulty or the problem with having local school boards make decisions about masks, that if you allow those sort of passions and people who's like, well, I saw this on MSNBC and I saw this on Fox News, and this is how we're going to make our decision based on who shouts the loudest at these meetings. I mean, I don't think you can have that. I do understand the concerns that Austin has brought up over time about how you don't want the governor just acting like a dictator in this, but I do think you need to defer to central authority and authority, actual authorities, people who know what they're talking about when you're talking about trying to control a pandemic.
You know, you can sit there and say, well, I don't believe this, I don't believe that, but what do you believe in? Okay, this is somebody, we'll talk about people who have flair for the dramatic. Isn't he one of the ones who walked onto the floor of the Senate? I'm sorry, the House without a mask on, and he was marched out.
One of the nine, I think so. Yeah.
He and several other Republicans were ordered removed from the House floor, you know, after a vote on violating the chamber's rules for masking.
That's what Bailey did a year ago, right?
Yeah, right. But then notably
did not do that this time, which is really odd.
But I didn't notice that. He wasn't one of them.
But he's in the state Senate now, so I don't know if that's become an issue in the state Senate as well.
He could have done a sympathy walk-off.
He could have.
In solidarity
with my brothers in the House. Vladimir Putin is poised to invade the eastern part of Ukraine. Let's talk about that now. This is all, of course, Joe Biden's fault. Just kidding. I don't think most people are actually thinking about this in red-blue political terms. There's some of that, but mostly I think Americans are looking at Russia and think that we as a country have few good options to deter the overrunning of a sovereign nation. Does anybody think that the United States should be committing troops on the ground? Should we be fighting this fight that way? Or
at this point, my expertise in foreign policy would tell me that everyone's laughing. Why? No, which is that you got to try sanctions first. And I think we're a long way off from committing U.S. troops. You said Putin is poised to invade Ukraine. I believe he has, in effect, into the separatist regions of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that the citizens of the United States are ready to sacrifice their sons and daughters for this cause yet. That they certainly would like to see people try all sorts of sanctions, try to put a lot of pain on Russians to get them to stand down. Sanctions don't have a great history of working, but you got to try.
There's something to be said for Zelensky's comments over the weekend in Munich about, what are you waiting for? we're already feeling this sort of vice grip of Russian troops. They've surrounded the country. I find any of this started to be some kind of a human rights thing. And I really get freaked out. This whole idea of like, let's clear the Americans out of this country that's about to be invaded. And, you know, everybody, you're on your own. I find that so chilling.
What I find fascinating about this whole situation is this tightrope that Biden has to kind of walk, in a sense, right? Americans have no appetite to get into a war, especially not with Russia. I don't have any polling on that. I just know. I'm pretty sure nobody wants to go to war right now. So he's got to strike this tone of aiding Ukraine's defense and de-escalating Russian aggression, and sanctions aren't doing that, clearly, and supporting NATO allies. And Ukraine is not part of NATO, but you don't want to go to war with Russia either. So this balance, it's so tricky right now. This needs to be a collective NATO effort, not just NATO forces of individual countries chipping in. The onus is more on NATO than it is on Biden.
If really severe sanctions go on to Russia, that the pain is going to be felt more in those European countries than it is over here, but it will be felt here as well. And I've been reading some things today about the various industries that are going to be impacted if we try to clamp down on Russian exports, that there are things that are critical to airplane manufacture and things like that.
But on the point of Germany, though, they ended this whole Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is this new offshore natural gas pipeline running under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. So that's a hard line. Yes, they do rely on natural gas, but they're putting an end to what would mean billions to Russia.
And you get the feeling that Putin knows how much it would hurt and he doesn't care? It's like his meals will still be hot. You know, I don't know how vulnerable he is to public pressure, the suffering that our sanctions would exert on his people, because he's Putin. He doesn't care. He is going to get Ukraine come hell or high water. And if we have to pay a high price at the pump or for parts, that's one thing. His people will suffer even more. I don't get the feeling he cares.
For all the criticism of Biden, I don't think it's right to I think he's done a pretty commendable job of uniting NATO and most European countries against this. The one thing I think that could be stronger is sort of, and Trump was terrible at this also with North Korea, but some kind of moral clarity and realism about the fact that some governments are simply evil. Their leaders lust after power. They seek to limit the freedom of their citizens, and these governments are a threat to global security. And I think that's a really important message. And I actually saw, I don't know about you guys, I saw 2008 Obama getting more criticism than 2021 Joe Biden, 2022 Joe Biden, mostly because of his, you know, remark to Mitt Romney that, I guess that was 2012, right? His remark to Mitt Romney that the 1980s called and they wanted their foreign policy back. He should be criticized for that. But I think Biden has mostly done a good job.
Do you think that Donald Trump's comments about this are going to resonate? He said on a conservative podcast,
well, what went wrong was a rigged election. And what went wrong is a candidate that shouldn't be there and a man that has no concept of what he's doing. I went in yesterday and there was a television screen and I said, this is genius. Putin declares a big portion of the Ukraine. Putin declares it as independent. Oh, that's wonderful. So Putin is now saying it's independent, a large section of Ukraine. I said, how smart is that? And he's going to go in and be a peacekeeper. That's the strongest peace force. We could use that on our southern border. Had I been in office, not even thinkable. This would never have happened. You got to say that's pretty savvy. And you know what the response was from Biden? There was no response.
I mean, it was just crazy stuff. It was so maybe even sarcastic that I didn't know if it should be taken seriously. You can get outraged by what he said, but I don't know that I need to put a lot of stock or worry in it either.
What Trump says, will it make a difference? Yeah, it seems to. He seems to have a lot of pull with his followers still. And so when he says that, he's openly expressing admiration for Putin's tactics and deriding President Biden, which is such a contravention of the sort of normal order of things when it comes to American politics, which is that that partisanship is supposed to stop at the water's edge. And now, of course, that's been not true for a while now. But this is a kind of situation where I think we need to exhibit a united front, that they're showing clips of Tucker Carlson over on Soviet TV, which is or Soviet Russian TV. Because he is talking up Putin and he's talking down Biden.
It's kind of an amazing lever, though, to use against Joe Biden, side with this invasion and say, well, Darren LaHood from downstate Illinois said, well, this is just more proof that Joe Biden has been mishandling the Russians. And I'm not sure that Donald Trump exactly handled them with a firm hand either.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking of Tyler Cowen, who is by no means a right-wing zealot, wrote a column in Bloomberg Opinion, which I thought was quite good. And he sort of was pining for the, in this moment, the clarity of a Reagan-type president. And the Republicans have moved so far away from that on so many things, including this, which if Reagan had seen what Russia was doing now, would his response be to the sitting Democratic president, like, oh, this guy's a loser. This Putin guy is pretty cool. It's good that he's strong. You know, he's got strong borders. Like, what kind of warped? This is a country that has moved militarily in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Syria. It imprisons political opponents. It clamps down on free speech. It is not a legitimate democracy. And for, you know, a former president to be siding with something like that is really, it's really sad.
Eric, I'm going to insert now the campaign 2020 drumbeat. Jumps out at you this week, Eric, besides we've had our gubernatorial talk, but what else is catching your eye?
Well, I was really struck by J.B. Pritzker's endorsement of Anna Valencia in the Democratic Secretary of State primary. I think it's really huge. And it was about a week ago that we talked about Jesse White, the popular Secretary of State, the outgoing retiring Secretary of State, endorsing Valencia and how that was a potential game changer. I think Pritzker's endorsement of Valencia, given his money, is not just a potential game changer, but a real game changer. Now, the main competitor for Valencia is Alexei Janulis, the former state treasurer. And he was considered to be the odds-on favorite to win this race. He was gathering endorsements. He's got the SEIU endorsement and the Cook County Democrats endorsement and a bunch of other key endorsements. He wrangled those fairly early. Valencia has come on very strong. Her fundraising has not caught up to Janulis's, but I think with Pritzker behind her, that it will catch up. Now, there's a Alderman David Moore is the 17th ward is the third candidate there. I don't think he's going to be a factor, but I think that this announcement by Pritzker, combined with Jesse White, combined before that, Senators Durbin and Duckworth have endorsed Valencia, that you'd have to right now call her the favorite.
Why do people care about the Secretary of State's race? Why does that animate you?
I was just about to say, what do we think, what qualifications and what causes a person to vote for one candidate for Secretary of State over another one? I think it's pretty close to John Williams' measure of
who has the prettiest,
who is more attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah, who has the prettiest commercials.
Well, before Jesse White,
thank you for that, by the way, Austin. When he was, thank you.
Wait a minute. The Secretary of State is widely considered a stepping stone to the governorship. I mean, Jim Edgar was Secretary of State. George Ryan was Secretary of State before they ascended to the governor's office. So it is one of the things where you are choosing somebody and you're elevating them and sort of putting them in the waiting room for a higher office, for Senate, for Secretary of State, for governor. So you have a situation where this person is sort of a potential high official. Secretary of State controls a lot of jobs, and a smooth functioning Secretary of State's office is a real blessing. And I think Jesse White has been really quite good at overseeing that office. I don't know how hands-on he truly is, but if you compare the experience of going to a driver's license facility now to what it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago, it's much better now. I think that he's put good people in place and they have a pretty good system there. And that's really important because that really affects your daily life in a way that, say, who the state treasurer or comptroller is does not.
Okay, but 20 or 25 years ago, That was sort of Jim Edgar and
George Ryan
stepping on deck to become governor. When it was running poorly, it didn't hurt those folks. I really don't know that it has that much of an effect on you know, whether it's running well or whether it's not. I do wonder too whether these endorsements mean anything or put somebody in a front runner status. It's all about the money. If Pritzker writes a big check, which he's expected to do, that will certainly help her. But it needs to happen soon because Janulius has been out there for some time, you know, crisscrossing the state.
Lisa, I think you're absolutely right about the fact that the endorsements themselves don't mean that much, but they do tend, money tends to follow them. And that's and you're absolutely right that the money is going to make a difference. I don't think that it makes that much difference that it's, you know, almost March and the money hasn't come in yet from Pritzker, because most people besides, you know, podcast geeks are not paying attention to these races yet. They're starting to pay attention to the governor's race, but I think the Secretary of State's race is still off most people's radars. I think that money would be wasted right now running a lot of TV commercials. So
I mean, it doesn't happen like that, though. The money's got to be there. You've got to be filming the ads. This stuff doesn't come together that quickly.
You know, I'm really intrigued by the politics that are kind of at play behind this. You know, one, Pritzker going against this, you know, Cook County Democratic Party, which endorsed Alexei, and they have like some sort of like promise pledge where you promise to sign your name to support whoever they support. And Pritzker said nah. And he's been a guy that's been pretty, he doesn't walk the party line all the time or just go with what the state Democrats or county Democrats always want. So I found that interesting. But also what's interesting, you know, Jesse White endorsing Anna Valencia was a signal for Pritzker to do the same, because Pritzker still has amends to make to Jesse White from when he offended Jesse White. What was it, Beck? He did like there was a leaked call from 2008 with Rob Blagojevich and yep. Pritzker. And he was talking about candidates to replace Obama in that state Senate seat. And he called Jesse White the least offensive to take Obama's Senate seat. And it was a whole thing. And when you come at Jesse White in the black community, that's a problem. We don't like that. We don't like it. He got the Jesse White tumblers. You don't touch Jesse White. Okay. So Pritzker had to apologize profusely, and he's still having to make sure that he doesn't alienate that key part of the Democratic base right there, and that's black folks. So when Jesse White signals, oh yeah, I'm endorsing Anna Valencia, yeah, Pritzker's gonna be like, I'm right behind you, bro. We're home.
Me too, yeah. You beat me to it, Jesse. Wow.
Really? So I don't want to sound so naive here, but Jesse tracks well with the black community in the state of Illinois and in the Chicago area.
Every community. He's the most popular politician.
Do you all get the sense like he's in charge? Like he's even aware of what's going on in his office?
Oh,
do you get the... What? What am I saying?
I think he understands.
He strikes you as being really competent and on the ball. I'm not saying he's incompetent. I'm just saying he's a guy who has that seat and the office is running itself and you just keep getting elected and we'll all be good here.
But that there is a certain competence there in to delegate.
That's one of you guys said
that bar is so low.
The Secretary of State's office has never been a better oiled machine. Who said that?
I did. I'm saying you know that he competently delegates authority. I mean, it's running well.
Okay.
So I mean, that's how you judge a Secretary of State. You can't say, well, is he actually designing the driver's licenses? is he moving little stanchions where people are standing in line? No, but he's got the people in place to make it run well, and that's what a leader does. I'm not in his office every day. I don't know, but I don't get the feeling that he's out of touch.
Well, maybe it's a more difficult office to run. There's a lot of offices and stuff, but you go, you stand in line, you give them the papers, then they click, 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 and then you give them some money, and then you get your driver's license, and that's, maybe I'm minimizing all of the things that walk in that door now that I think about it, because one great thing about the Secretary of State's office is that it's so democratic, right, with a small D. There are the people. There's bankers and brokers, and then there's people who are homeless, and they all got to get their stuff done, and it's if you ever wonder who the people are, if you will, go to the Secretary of State's office.
I got to give credit to Illinois because I've had licenses in Indiana and Ohio, getting my license in Illinois was way easier.
Really?
Than I expected. Way easier than it ever was in any of those other states. So something's going right.
Just leave a 20 on the table and everything goes very smoothly.
You know, usually you're waiting in line forever. I mean, Illinois has got a system. You can, you know, make appointments online. Indiana still don't got that. Ohio, they don't even have that. So
no. I was at City Hall and I was getting my temporary tags for people to park in front of my condo. You know, those little they're pink this year stickers you get. And so I went downtown to get those. And one of the nice things about having a pandemic is that not many people are coming downtown. Maybe it's the crime in the city, but boy, if you have some administrative thing you got to do with the city.
Yeah, if you
want to
do anything,
do it now. Do it now, man. Come to the Loop and just walk right in. There is nobody in front of you. I want to talk about Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Roddy Bryant for just a couple of minutes, guys, to see if you have any strong feelings about a federal jury which has convicted them all over again. They were found guilty of Ahmaud Arbery's murder in a state court, but now a federal court has found them guilty because they say that crimes were committed against Arbery because of his race. These were federal hate crimes. And so even though those guys are going to go to jail for life, they were found guilty of a whole new set of crimes. For instance, even if those guys had been found not guilty in a state court, they still could be found guilty in a federal court for these hate crimes, and they should be duly prosecuted for them, and they were.
It was a slam dunk federal hate crime case. They had posts and social media messages and things like that from the McMichaels, even in conversation with each other, using the N-word and using racial slurs and talking about black people in denigrating ways. So right there, you've got, you know, a basis for there's hatred right there. Right. So it was a slam dunk case. It's not one that I'll be honest with you. As a black person in America, I at this point have tuned some of this stuff out because I just expect the worst and for things not to go that way or for these guys to not be found guilty. But they're found guilty because the evidence was clear. The question is, what happens when the evidence is not that clear? When you can't find those social media posts, when you can't find those clear messages, but it should be clear to the average person that, yeah, obviously there was a racial motive here. Right. So that's what I'm wondering for the future. But it's definitely a win momentarily when it comes to, you know, these social justice fights that we deal with.
Is it another layer of win that it was a mostly white jury in the South? Does that maybe amplify the win, if you will, Brandon?
In a sense, but it's also one of those where if that jury would have went the opposite, people would have been up in arms because, like, it was just so in your face and obvious.
Right.
How could you not? There's a lot of things that factor there, but yes, having it be an all-white jury, too, that decides this when the evidence is abundantly clear that this was a hate crime, yeah, that's a good thing. But it's sad, though, that has to be a win. It should be an automatic, and the evidence is there, you know?
Mostly white jury. And
it was mostly, yeah.
And weren't you all just impressed with how stupid these guys are? I mean, guys, do not commit your bigotry to the internet, which zillions of people do zillions of times a day, but it's a permanent digital record. If they needed to make a case against you for that reason, they can. And forget a federal court. How about your next employer or the woman you want to meet someday? I mean, it's just amazing to me how transparent people are on the internet where that stuff lives forever.
Was it on the internet or was it on text messages where most of that?
Well, I think some of it was on Facebook, Eric.
They had Facebook posts and Twitter stuff.
But maybe a text message doesn't qualify as a digital imprint, but evidently they were able to mine these things and find that information out about them.
Yeah, how about just don't be racist? How's that?
Well, that would be another layer of victory, Brandon. That would be even better, wouldn't it?
That would help.
It's interesting because I don't think there was any possibility that they would serve more time after this conviction. So it was essentially just a symbolic prosecution.
Yeah.
Probably worth it given the case itself, how high profile it was, even though there was no practical effect of it. It really laid down a marker. And as Brandon points out, there was a risk, right, that if they didn't get a conviction, then you'd say, well, if this isn't a hate crime, then what is? So I suppose you commend them for that, for taking that chance.
I did think a little bit about the Jason Van Dyke case when you had a conviction in a state court. And in Illinois, we didn't get federal charges, but in Georgia they did. And I don't know that these things are that similar, but where people were wishing that John Lausch's office had taken up a case against Jason Van Dyke, the officer that shot Laquan McDonald, and didn't, you did have federal charges in Georgia. And so I wondered if there was something to be borrowed from that, that it just reminds us of the missed opportunity. Because like Eric said, in the case of the McMichaels and Roddy Bryan, you can't go to jail for two life terms. But in the case of Jason Van Dyke, you could have put him away for even longer if there had been federal charges against him, and there were not. So it kind of made me scratch my head or wonder again if that wasn't a almost missed opportunity for more justice.
I think it was a missed opportunity, but that it was missed 3 years ago when Van Dyke had finished his case in Cook County Court. The feds should have taken it over right then. To have done it when Van Dyke was being released would have really, I think, it would have struck a kind of a jarring double jeopardy kind of note at the time. We'd like, well, he got out now, so we're going to try to put him back in. I think that would have been a more difficult sell. I don't know. I mean, it's still possible that Lausch will file those charges. He's not said anything about it, right?
No, he has not.
But it seems unlikely. But the feds don't tell us what they're doing very often. So it's possible. But again, I think that the time for this would have been at the time, you know, right after the completion of his criminal trial in Cook County, to have turned around and filed those federal charges. So it didn't quite look like you were just piling on because you were mad about the sentence or something.
One more case I want you guys just to consider. We didn't talk about Tom DeVore, the downstate lawyer who wants to be attorney general.
Tom DeVore is kind of a clown of an attorney who's been going around filing all kinds of legal challenges to Pritzker's use of powers regarding COVID-19. He's the guy behind the anti-mask mandates and so on. I just don't see him as a serious candidate for attorney general, because I don't. He has his only experiences in filing these pesky lawsuits. I think he just wants more attention.
Do you think, similar to Bailey, though, will pose a pretty substantial threat, because the other candidate, like a Richard Ervin, for example, doesn't have a Republican base that he can go to in a Republican primary, right? But he's going to have a lot of money. Similarly, there's a Ken Griffin supposedly will back a slate of candidates, including someone for attorney general. You're basically going to go up against this guy who, I agree with Eric, is, you know, very flashy and does not scream competence in the courtroom. Although he's had a ton of failed lawsuits, though, but this one is going to the Illinois Supreme Court, but has a rabid fan base of Republican primary voters. So, I mean, if you're Kwame Raoul, you hope that guy gets out of the Republican primary.
Brandon, you weren't here last week when we talked a little bit about the punch that Juwan Howard threw at the end of the Michigan basketball game against Wisconsin. You know what's frustrating to me is that as much as people keep playing that handshake line, I missed the game. I've just seen over and over again the punch that the University of Michigan basketball coach Juwan Howard threw at the Wisconsin coach. And then a scrum developed between coaches and players, and it was really ugly. And Juwan Howard's been suspended for the rest of the season, though he will be able to coach the team in the Big Ten tournament, and they probably won't do well there.
Hey.
I want to see the last 5 minutes of the game on the court to see how reasonable the peak was that one coach had against the other. I'd like to see the last 5 minutes of it.
You don't need to see the last 5 minutes. You really only need to see the last minute or so. And the answer to your question is that Michigan was unsportsmanlike, in my view. And I'm a Michigan grad.
Right.
Bleed maize and blue, and I'm distraught about how this turned out. But what happened was that Michigan was down by, you know, about 19 points at one point in the last minute, and they had their starters still in, putting full court pressure on the Wisconsin scrubs, who got put in with about 49 seconds left. So Michigan is still playing really hard. They scored a basket with 22 seconds left. They're putting on this full court pressure, and the walk-ons and backups are trying to bring the ball up the court, and they're having a hard time against Michigan starters who are pressing them. And so the coach calls timeout. the Wisconsin coach calls timeout so that this resets the 10-second clock to get the ball across the court, and it also gives him a chance to talk to his guys about how to break this press. The timeout infuriated Juwan Howard, the Michigan coach. So as he's going through the line, the handshake line, he starts chirping at the head coach of Wisconsin. And they start going at each other and finger pointing. The coach of Wisconsin grabs Juwan Howard's arm. And then this other assistant coach comes up and joins the fray somehow. And Howard doesn't punch him. He sort of slaps his head. The people say it's a punch, but it was sort of an open-handed slap at his head. A really, really dumb thing for Howard to do. But my analysis of it is that Michigan was really unsportsmanlike. When you're down by 16 points with 22 seconds to go, you let the other team dribble the ball out, and you stand there with your hands on your hips looking glum and accepting that you've lost. And Michigan didn't do that, and that is an unwritten rule that needs to be followed. And so I put the blame squarely on Michigan there. I will let Brandon, now as an Ohio State fan, savor my humiliation here.
Ultimately, what's been nauseating about this whole situation is now the discourse. Everyone's like, should we just get rid of the handshake line? And I'm just wait, is that how we handle problems? One thing goes wrong, and we're just like, yeah, let's just get rid of the entire system.
The pretense of good sportsmanship is now exposed.
The whole point of the handshake line is to de-escalate. When something happens during a game and you're feeling hot, you're really upset, the point of the handshake line is to come together and say, hey, all right, it's just a game. Good job. That's sportsmanship, right? That's just like a tenet of playing team sports. Juwan Howard, I mean, yeah, I get why he was upset. I didn't watch the game. Who would? But
That's two, Eric, right there.
I'm sorry, bro. I'm sorry. But, you know, he's from the south side of Chicago. Should he have been fired for it? Not at all. Suspended? Absolutely. I've seen worse things in college basketball. I've seen coaches literally try to fight other coaches, run up on them in press conferences. John Calipari was a victim of that once. You know, so for this guy, Juwan Howard, to do what he did, it was unacceptable. You're a coach. You're supposed to be a leader of young men. You're supposed to be the guy that's stopping your young men from doing something like this. You should not be the one to actively do it. But I'll tell you what, I guarantee you those young men in that locker room, they are going to fight for their coach. They're going to be 10 times more loyal to their coach. That's the type of stuff that gets a locker room motivated. And Eric, you might like this. That could be something that propels Michigan to win the Big Ten tournament.
Wow.
Because they're going to need it. Because they're out of the tournament at this point.
As we record this, of course, Michigan is about to face Rutgers, a pretty hot Rutgers team,
yeah,
Wednesday night. By the time anyone hears this, the game will be over. If Michigan beats Rutgers, gets fired up, they could go on a short winning streak and maybe earn their way into the NCAA tournament, where I predict they will make the final four.
I made a joke earlier before we started the pod that Juwan Howard is making black history. He's the first black man to ever assault a white coworker on the job and not get fired for it. And so what a great way to end Black History Month, I guess.
And so it's one way to position that if he was actually thinking it through, because sometimes coaches will leave the bench in a baseball game and say, okay, I'm going to get thrown out. Mm-hmm. So this will motivate the team. So maybe we'll end up winning this game or the next game. Like it's sometimes calculated. I don't think it was calculated though, Brandon. I think he was out of his mind. He literally could not control his actions. That's what that looked like, right?
Yes. And I will say this, though. As a coach, that should never be, right? Like, you're supposed to be the standard. Like, we've all seen hothead coaches, no doubt. I mean, Bob Knight in basketball. He threw chairs. But you still have a standard to hold. The leash for Juwan Howard at this point is, like, this small, right? This man can't do anything wrong from this point forward, because Michigan will be well within their right to get rid of them. And that's unfortunate, because Juwan Howard, from all accounts I've heard, is a great man, a great leader of men. He is obviously from that Fab Five Michigan team, one of the great Chicago basketball legends. But there's just no room in the sport for something like that. Emotions got the best of him. It happens. Let's hope it doesn't happen again.
I'm surprised they're letting him coach in the tournament. Go ahead, Eric.
I was wondering, Lisa, as a high school basketball player, what do you think about this?
I've been thinking a lot about sort of the sportsmanship and all the stuff that we learned, especially young, like grade school. But some of the folks that I've seen played basketball, boys basketball, men's basketball, some of the folks I follow on Twitter, like the rule was broken when he called the timeout. So I would have been ticked off too, and I probably would have taken that swipe. But there's a lot of folks out there that say, no, you know, he didn't throw the first punch. It's a game. It's important, but it's also just a game. And we're humans who played that game. And to kind of get rid of that seems strange. And he deserves to be suspended. And,
yeah, he did have a shouting match with a Maryland coach during the Big Ten tournament last year. It's put him on a little bit of thin ice. But yeah, you're right. You lose a game, you get him next time, right?
I'm always amazed, too, at the fact that here, especially in football games, too, where it's even more physical, but coaches and players who are screaming at each other, trying to, in football, you know, break each other's neck, and then you line up and you shake their hands. Not exactly like that in football, but they generally tend to meet on the in the middle of the field in the NFL. In a college basketball, they line up and then say, nice game, nice game, nice game, nice game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, Brandon, we should not get rid of the handshake line, even if you don't mean it. You should have to walk that walk. By the way,
it's a great thing to teach our kids.
Yeah.
It is. I got in trouble because I was playing soccer, and a kid who went to my same grade school was on another soccer team, was a city team, and we'd even bet on it, like a buck. I mean, I hated her.
and we
lost. And oh my God, I was not going to go out there. Well, I was sort of taken by the collar, and you will get out there, fourth grade Lisa. And man, I didn't play the next game. The coach had to march me out there. I didn't play the next game.
Suspended.
You pay the dollar too, by the way?
I paid the dollar.
Yeah.
I think I slapped it in her hand. That was
mad. Producer Peach has handed me this note. Speaking of, I wonder which incident this is. You're talking about Bobby Knight here, right? The chair throwing?
It was
on this day, February 23rd. Is today February 23rd?
Wow.
In 1985, the Bobby Knight threw the chair across the court. So
wow.
I guess on that full circle note, we will end today's podcast with and everybody.
Dave, a little bit infamy.
Way to go,
chair,
Pete.
Happy chair day.
Good call, Pete.
Yeah, no kidding.
Love our research team.
And by the way, at the end of the podcast, no matter how angry or animated we get, we all line up and shake each other's hands. Good podcast, Brandon. Good podcast, Austin. Good podcast,
good
Lisa.
Good job, guys.
Good podcast.
Good game.
Except me. John has to grab me by the collar. Me.
Lisa, you will say nice things to Austin right now.
Thank you.
Take Go care. Blue.
Bye.
Oh, no.
You guys.
Go Blue. Okay. You're in timeout now, Eric.
Oh, man. I'll see you guys later.
See you, Brandon.
Thanks, everybody. That was fun.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com. Thank you.